that this is one of the strangest stories in the Bible, and I fully concur. It's challenging. It's interesting, but it's challenging. We're in Luke 16. We're going to cover the first 18 verses tonight. At least that's our target. So to get right to it. But now, before we get right to it, I want to set the stage in chapter 14, verse 25. Now, we know we're in the last week before he arrives at Jerusalem, or very shortly. Remember, he said, in 3 days, I'll be at Jerusalem. We're in that 3 day window before he gets to Jerusalem. In verse 25, 14:25 says, great multitudes were going along with him, and he turned and he talked to them about the price of discipleship. Then down in chapter 15 at verse 1, the tax gatherers and the sinners were coming to hear it. So he's got this multitude of people. And then the Pharisees, verse 2, and the scribes began to grumble about Jesus' lack of decorum, if you will. He wasn't keeping all their traditions spotlessly. And then here we come, and so he told several parables about rejoicing over one coming to re these pe these off scouring of society, these disenfranchised people in verse 1 that were coming to him. He's showing the Pharisees and the scribes that you ought to be rejoicing like heaven is, rather than grumbling like Satan is, or whatever. You ought to be rejoicing. So he had three parables, the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the lost son. And then we come to chapter 16. And as he was also saying to the disciples, there was a certain rich man, and he goes into this story that we're going to try to unravel. And we come down to verse 14. The Pharisees, who were lovers of money, who were listening to all these things, they began scoffing at him. So you got this, you've got these people that are hanging on Jesus' words, but you've also got this crowd of people that are trying to discredit Jesus at every turn. And far from being discredited, he shows the ridiculousness of their resistance. So that's where we are here as we come into chapter 16 then. And I'm going to just read down through verse 8, and then we'll see what we can do about deciphering and unraveling and making sense of it. Now, he was also saying to the disciples, so he finished those three parables. And I've got more I want to tell you. So he was also saying to the disciples. Now, what we had in chapter 15 was his response to, well, he's eating with the offscouring of society. He dealt with that. Now he's got another parable. And let's see what we can make out of it. There was a certain rich man who had a steward. And this one was reported to him as squandering his possessions. And he called him and said to him, what is this I hear about you? Give an account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be steward. And the steward said to himself, what am I going to do? My master is taking the stewardship away from me. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm too ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do, so that when I am removed from the stewardship, they will receive me into their homes. And he summoned each one of his master's debtors and began saying to the first, how much do you owe my master? And he said, 100 measures of oil. He said to him, take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then he said to another, how much do you owe? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. He said to him, take your bill and write 80. And his master praised the unrighteous steward because he had acted shrewdly. For the sons of this age are more shrewd in relation to their own kind than the sons of light. I'm going to stop there. And I don't know if I able to unravel this with you or not, but let's see what we can do. So this guy, a rich man, certain rich man. We don't know who the rich man was. If I were a rich man, never mind. If I were a rich man, a certain rich man had a steward. What's a steward? Does yours say something other than steward? Anybody?
Manager.
Manager.
Yeah, some say
Manager.
manager.
Manager. Manager, manager, manager. Okay. Steward is a more precise word than manager, in only from the standpoint of understanding the level of responsibility, the level of what's the word I'm looking for? Charge.
Responsibility.
How much discretion? That's a good word. How much discretion the man had. It pretty much the Greek word is house law, law of the house. He was the one that made the laws. Now the owner would say, "This is what I want to accomplish," but the steward or the manager had total control over what was being done with the goods of the master, or the concerns of the master. Well, the master somehow heard that, let me see, it was reported to him. We're not told who did the reporting. It's not critical to the story, but that he was squandering. What does squander mean to you? He's squandering his possessions,
Waste, just wasting it.
wasting it, spending it on frivolous things, not concerned with the master's interest, not driven by what will please my master, but wasting it away. Go ahead. Oh, okay. And so says, what I've call he called him and says, what's this I hear about you, that you give an accounting of your management. Let's see, I think the New American Standard, the most recent version, give an accounting of your management. Give an account of your stewardship is what the 95 version says. But I think give an accounting of it. I want everything that is outstanding written down. I want the account. See, it's not, well, explain it to me. I want the account. I want the ledger. I mean, he says, sit down quickly and write this. So he wanted something written down. The master was looking for, okay, let's stop the bleeding and see what it is that I have collectible. And so give me that. You give me the accounts. Well, that's what a steward being stripped of his stewardship would have to do, isn't it? To give a finished record. And the next steward is going to have to work with something rather than just so he's got this the record, the written record that he has to give to his master. He says, what am I going to do? I'm not going to have a job anymore. And I don't have the strength to go out and do manual labor. That to me sounds like a cop out, because how long does it take to build the strength to do the work you need to do? So why not say, I just don't want to work and I don't want to beg. So what am I going to do? Well, yeah, I figured it out. He says, here's
Bye.
what I'm going to do. I'll call people to me and I'm going to work in such a way that they'll be glad to put me up when I'm kicked out. And I don't know, and you don't know either, but I suspect there might be some underhandedness going on here as well. If you
Rod.
don't put me up, then I'll tell my master what you really owe. Now, I don't know. We're just not told that. But he says, I'm going to do something so that when I am kicked out of my stewardship, I'll have a place to land. But I'll also, and here's my thinking, I'll also have that a little detail that I can hold over them that they're not going to want me to rat them out, so they will give me a place to stay. That's my thoughts on that. Any thoughts? I see your hand up, Michael. Does that mean something?
Mary, can you hear me okay?
I hear you just fine. You hear me?
Oh yeah, but Mary was trying to get hold of you, so here she is.
I just was finding it
Oh.
very interesting for a person who's a manager. They're supposed to know how much everything is. He shouldn't have to ask the person that, owes. So that just is a more testament to how lazy he was about what his job was. He had to ask them.
Interesting. Interesting. It may be that he didn't know, like Mary's suggesting. It may be that he's using it to emphasize how big a discount I'm giving you. I don't know. At any rate, here he is with these guys. So the first fella, I owe him 100 measures of, well, I don't know what that's worth. That's not the point. Okay, sit down quickly and write 50. Before anybody else hears what you just said, write down 50. We'll put it on the ledger that you owe 50. Okay. What about you? Well, I owe 100 measures of wheat. Well, write down 80. And so we've got they know what they owe. They see what they have to pay instead. And there's this, and how many are doing it? They just called these two, but I suspect that they're more than the two, but these two are enough to illustrate what's going on. And so look at verse 8 and tell me what you think about verse 8. And his master praised the unrighteous steward. The master praised him. Hello, Candy. What do you think about that?
That's the weird.
Okay, the
I have a comment.
master, go ahead, Devin.
Well, just being shrewd isn't necessarily bad, but it's what he was doing with his shrewdness that.
Yeah, the word shrewd, it probably fits the context well, but the word shrewd simply means sensible. Using your wits to, and so it's not necessarily derogatory, but in this case, he's taking advantage, isn't he? Okay. And so his master used to say, the master, the Lord, the Lord. And so this verse used to cause a great deal of confusion that the Lord, like in the King James Version, maybe even in the American Standard. The Lord praised the unrighteous manager, unrighteous steward. What? Jesus praised that? No, the reality is you got a couple. This story is filled with crooks. Either they were they're crooked in their actions, or they're crooked in their, what is it that it says at the end of Romans 1, who knowing the ordinance of God, not only realize that those who do such things are worthy of death, they give hearty approval to them. That's the hearty approval. This manager said, wow, that was pretty shrewd. That guy's got some wits, and he didn't take him to, I mean, he found out, obviously found out. I don't know if he had nothing he could do about it. But the point is, the master said, that was a pretty slick thing. That's a kind of a slick way for you to take care of yourself using, and here, let's boil it right down to get to the gist of it. Jesus is talking here about how people can use what's been entrusted to them to guarantee their future. Would you agree with me that that's the picture that's being painted? Not to say that everybody is crooked, but even when you have something entrusted to you, find a way to use what's been entrusted to you that will provide for your future. And that's what Jesus is saying. See, the master is a crook too. The guys who wrote down 50 instead of 100, they're crooks. The guy that wrote down 80 instead of 100, he's cheating as well. And so there's a whole bunch of crooks in here. The steward, the debtors, and the master. They're all saying, man, that's a pretty slick thing you got going on there. But why did Jesus then tell this thing? He says in verse 8, he says, for the sons of this age, the sons of this age are more shrewd in relation to their own kind than the sons of light, more sensible. They know how to get things done. But tell me, who are the sons of this age? What's he talking about? The sons of this age.
Sons of, oh.
The sons of this age are more shrewd in relation to their own kind than the sons of light. You see the contrast? Mm-hmm. The sons of this age, the sons of light.
Well, the sons of this age is anyone that's not following Jesus.
Okay. What age is he talking about?
Moses.
I think he's talking about the age of Moses.
Yeah.
The sons of this age, the age of Moses, the age in which the Pharisees and the scribes are giving Jesus a hard time for all he's teaching. You guys, you don't know how to use what you've been entrusted to get into the kingdom. Now, you're shrewd, like these crooks, to advance what you think is your future, your well-being, but you don't. And the sons of light aren't using what they've got to advance their well-being. This is a challenging thought to me, this and I remember something Linda mentioned several years ago about how that the followers of Jesus up to the destruction of Jerusalem, which, by the way, was the end of this age, those followers would sell their property. We see that in Acts. Sell their property and take the proceeds and provide for the poor who couldn't get work because they followed Jesus, or provide for the poor who had come to town and stayed when they heard the gospel and thus were living on fumes, or who would sell their property and provide for the preaching of the gospel. That these people who had turned their property into money to invest in the bank of heaven through their generosity were guilty of insider trading. They knew that their property was going to be seized and they'd get nothing from it. So instead of trying to promote their well-being in life, they instead said, let's support the gospel. Let's bank on the bank of heaven. And what am I trying to say? What I'm trying to say is this shrewd guy that was following the money, and that's really what he's after. How am I going to be taken care of? He found ways to make sure that he would be taken care of. What about the sons of light? Are they tracking with the Pharisees, or they're going to break away from that and follow the teaching of Jesus, even if it puts them into a physical poverty? See, it was a challenge to his disciples to see whether or not they were lovers of money or trusters of God. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, the steward was only concerned for his own well-being, which are like the sons of that age.
Yes.
Where the sons of light were concerned with the well-being of everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. The sons of that age, illustrated by the steward, would find ways that they had under their control to try to guarantee their future. And I think Jesus is talking to the sons of light Today, that's not the path that'll get you where you're going. Because I mean, that's what's next. Let me go ahead and read then down through, what do I want to go down through verse 13. So verse 8, I'll reread that for connective. And his master praised the unrighteous steward because he had acted shrewdly. For the sons of this age are more shrewd in relation to their own kind than the sons of light. And I say to you, make friends for yourselves by means of the wealth of unrighteousness. Mammon is wealth. If your version says mammon, it means wealth or the coin of the realm, money. Make friends for yourselves, just like the unjust steward did. Make friends for yourself by means of the wealth of unrighteousness, so when it fails, they will receive you into the eternal dwellings. He who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much, and he who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. Therefore, if you've not been faithful in the unrighteous wealth, who will entrust true wealth to you? And if you've not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. And so there he cuts right down to it. The unjust steward was serving wealth. How can I make sure I have a pile of wealth to land on? His version of the golden parachute, as it were. How can I make sure I have that? Well, that's where his shrewdness, his sensibility, his senses came to, his wits were about him. He was reasoning. He was using wisdom of a very carnal nature, just promoting his own future. Very short-sighted, I would say, because of that was a dead-end road, but that's the different point. He was using what he had in his control to get to the goal that he desired. Because the sons of light aren't doing that as much. Maybe they lack the faith to trust God, even if it means divesting themselves at this point. Say, so Jesus is addressing that. Make friends, verse 9, for yourselves. You make friends, just like that guy made friends, for yourselves by means of the money that you have under your control. Use what you have, use your stewardship to make friends so that when it fails, what fails? The money? The life? What's failing there in verse 9? So that when it fails,
From society,
well, the it has to refer to what's in context, doesn't it? Make friends with the money or the wealth of unrighteousness so that when it, the wealth of unrighteousness, fails.
When society fails, the money fails.
Well, or when society fails you, when society turns on you because you're a follower of me, that's going to fail. You're going to run out of money. And that's exactly what happened in the late the final throes of Judah's existence, 60 to 70 AD. That's what happened. Christians were black marketed. They couldn't work except under the counter, under the table, as it were. They were not permitted to buy. They had to eke out a living. Then that's so their money failed, but their dwelling didn't. I think Jesus is preparing his disciples to make a very hard choice. Are you going to spend your life pursuing and acquiring and treasuring money? Are you going to use what you have under control to pursue the palaces of heaven. What did Paul say in to Timothy? Let's look over here in
Hi,
Timothy.
Tim. He said, "Hi, Tim."
Hi, Tim. That's what he said. That no, that's what I say. But in 1 Timothy, I think it's 6. First Timothy, there it is. He says in verse 17, 1 Timothy
What chapter?
6. 1 Timothy 6:17. Instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited. Look what I've earned, or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. Who's your God? Is it your bank account, or is it your heavenly Father? What do you depend upon for your future? Your bank account or your heavenly Father? Instead, instruct them to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share. The concept would be, of course, that here's this lowly fellow who can't put beans on his table, and here's this rich man who can. He can put beans on that poor man's table, doing God's work for him, God working through. It all depends upon the reference point. Am I needing this for my future, or am I needing God for my future, and I can use this now to advance his causes? What is a steward? One who's been put in charge of somebody else's property to advance the cause of that somebody else. Okay? So Jesus is teaching that whatever money or wealth that I have is actually a stewardship from God to be used to advance God's goals. And so, I know I'm preaching to the choir, but I'm just trying to ferret out what this is all about. That we say this world is not my home, I'm just a passing through. Well, this money's not mine either. It's just something that has been entrusted to me to do the bidding of my master who owns it. What is it? What psalm is it? Psalm 50, I think, says God owns the cattle on a thousand hills. Of course, that's figurative speaking there. He owns all the cattle. They're his. They're not ours. They're entrusted to us to use. And how we use them is, well, what does he say here? So that when it fails, that whenever your entrustment runs out or falls away or leaves you, the word literally means to leave off, it leaves, that you will be received into the eternal dwellings. I mean, it's really a strong motivation to me, and I hope to you as well, to realize that what I have has been entrusted to me by God for me to live this life, but provide for the needs of others. It could be the needs of their flesh, it could be the needs of their spirit, but that God can use me as a conduit. And as long as I conduit, he will too, take care of people through me. And so, that I think what Jesus is getting at. You have a stewardship. Use it in such a way that when either your stewardship fails, like it did for these people, when the property was seized, you can read Hebrews 10 about the seizure of their property and the imprisonment that they endured. These people that are listening to Jesus here went through what the Hebrews writer described. In chapter Hebrews 10, 32, remember the former days when, after being enlightened, you endured a great conflict of sufferings, Hebrews 10, 32, partly by being made a public spectacle through reproaches and tribulations and severe pressure, and partly by becoming sharers with those who were so treated. For you showed sympathy to the prisoners, accepted joyfully the seizure of your property, knowing that you have for yourselves a better possession and an abiding one. And so they took Jesus' admonition seriously. They weren't holding on to their property. They were using what they had to bless others, serve others, minister to others, so that they would receive you into the eternal dwellings. So Jesus said, if you're faithful in a very little thing, you'll be faithful in much. I didn't get that one as a kid, did you? I was in 4-H, and I had maybe 8 to 10 chickens. I wanted 50 chickens, you know, for egg production. But I was really lax at making sure my chickens had feed and water, and that their bedding was changed out periodically. And Mom and Dad said to me, when you can show us that you're able to take care of a few, we'll let you get more. I said, my counter was, well, you know, if I had more, I'd take care of more. And their thought was, if you're not even going to take care of these, we're not going to trust you with more. I wonder how God looks at us. Now, we have a little, we have a lot. You know, how much do we have? And God looks and says, how are you using it? How are you using what I've entrusted to you? If you just have a little bit and you're not using at least some of it for my purposes, you're like unjust, this wicked, this scoundrel of a steward. You're just using it all on you. Well, why would I give you any more? But so he says, if you're faithful in a little, you'll be faithful in a lot. Bev, we are in Luke 16, down right around verse 10. He was faithful in a very little thing, is faithful also in much. In verse 9, Jesus said, make friends by the way you use what's been entrusted to you. And verse 10, he looks at the faithfulness to the charge that God has put upon you. He was faithful in a little thing, is faithful also in much. And he who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. So you get to prove your worth, not because you got a lot to deal with, but because of who you are. It's either a tiny little bit or a lot of big little bit or a big, big bit. But it's not the size of the entrustment that proves your faithfulness. It's the focus of your heart. And that's then where the entrustment comes. And verse 9, being received into the eternal dwellings. And he says, if you have not been faithful in the unrighteous wealth, that is, this unrighteous wealth doesn't mean that you came across your wealth by unscrupulous means. It just means the money that pertains to the life that we're going through. The dark and wicked world, we make money in it, okay? We spend money in it. We make our living in it. If you can't be faithful in that, then who is going to entrust the true wealth to you? The point, of course, is the idea of your focus and faithfulness, okay? Your focus and faithfulness. That's the point. And so do you want for God to entrust you with true wealth? Prove your faithfulness with what you have. Big or little, prove your faithfulness by using what you have for his purposes. Using what you've been entrusted by him for his purposes. Now, part of that, I mean, there's two things I see going on right there. I'm going to share them with you. Number one, where is your heart? Do you really want God's purposes on this earth to flourish? Okay. You go to the Lord's Prayer. How does that go? before he says, give us this day our daily bread, he says, may your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. We want your will to prevail. See, we want your will to be what. And so there is a proof of that where my heart is my heart with God, or is it just with the things of this earth? You know, if I scrimp and save, I can get myself a speedboat. You know, I might finally get a speedboat by the time I'm too old to drive it. If I scrimp and save, well, why would I want a speedboat? Well, it's fun. And I'm not against speedboats. But what about if I scrimp and save, could I support a gospel preacher somewhere, or make sure that the food bank has the supplies it needs? I mean, where's my focus? You see the point I'm making? Where's my focus? And the second thing is, do I trust God to take care of me if I divest myself? Do I trust God that if I'm busy doing his work, putting my heart into his work, putting my possessions into his work, do I trust that he will take care of me? And so Paul said to the Colossians in Colossians 3 at verse 5, that covetousness, you know, what is covetousness? That's not a word we use very often, is it? Covetousness. There, I've just used it three times. What does it mean, covetousness?
Wanting what belongs to someone else.
That is more like, to someone else is not a critical part of covetousness. The Greek word is literally to have more. I want more.
So you're not thankful for what you have.
What I have is not enough.
Yes. There's an ingratitude is there. Envy is also there. I think ingratitude and envy,
well,
actually are the two ingredients for covetousness.
Yeah. What? How much is enough? When do you know you have enough?
$5.
$5. Okay. How do you know when you have enough?
When you have food and a place to live.
Paul says, having
content,
having a food and covering, we shall therewith be content. How do you know you have enough? If you're drawn to things, going to get this, and you know, I hear this ad come on the radio every once in a while. How long? And the average time, I heard it driving away from here. Yesterday, Linda and I went out for breakfast, and came over here and picked up some stuff to take up to Green River College. And as I was driving out, I heard this ad. The average age of a TV set is 6 years. Imagine having to watch the same TV for 6 years. Why not get a new one? And if you're going to get a new one, get a bigger one. How much is it? And we can be driven by the desire to have more, to have more, to have more. Paul says, Colossians 3, 5, covetousness, which is idolatry. Now, why call it idolatry? Because that's what you're worshiping.
The
acquiring or the possessing or the having of things. Idolatry. Rather than trusting that my God knows what I need and will provide what I need, not necessarily what I want, but what I need. He'll take care of me. And here's a hint, everybody. Here's a hint. If he sees that you're busy doing his work, he's not going to dry up the spigot on that one. He can make sure, and I know this because it's what Paul said, is not only reasonable, but it's what Paul said, that he will provide and multiply your seed for sowing. That's in 2 Corinthians chapter 9. All right. So, and if you have not been, verse 12, if you've not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? Well, I'm not going to give you anything because you obviously don't know how to use it well. So he says, verse 13, no one, no servant can serve two masters. What are the two masters he's thinking about here?
God and self, well,
He
indulgence,
mentions it at the end of the verse, doesn't he?
mammon.
You cannot serve God and wealth. You just can't. You can't put your heart into serving God if you're so concerned about making, having money to spend upon yourself. You can't do both. He says you'll either hate the one and love the other. Well, no, I love God, but I love money too. Jesus says, no, you don't. It's a lie you're telling yourself. You say, I love God, but I love money too. I'm going to take this overtime so I can have more money. Well, why do you want more money? Well, things. Now, if it were, I'm going to take this overtime because it's offered to me because the food bank is running out of food and I can put more food on the table if I have more. That's different, isn't it? Because that's not the focus on getting money, that's the focus on serving God. And this is just a tool to get there. But you can't, you'll hate one and love the other. You can't say, I really love God, but I just love this money stuff. You'll turn your back on God to get the money. Or you'll be devoted to one and despise the other. God's standing in my way again. I wonder how many people look at having to spend this time studying together or worshiping together on Sunday or some other time slice out of their week, and they begrudge it, or they just don't do it because they've got other things they'd rather do. And so despising the things of God, you cannot serve God and wealth. I wrote a question down to myself here, and maybe we've exhausted it already, but how does one serve wealth? You cannot serve God and wealth.
Well, you can serve it on a platter to somebody else.
Okay. Serve it on a platter to somebody else. How do you serve well?
Well, by indulge, self-indulge, in this day and age, it's pretty obvious.
Yeah, and this is where Colossians 3:5 comes in. Covetousness, which is idolatry.
Adultery.
What is, look at the word idolatry. What is it? Idolatry.
It's false gods. It's worshiping false gods.
Idos is what you see, and latria is worship. Worshiping what you see, making that your God. Yeah, I can see the size of my bank account. You cannot serve God and that. It's just, Jesus didn't say you shouldn't. He didn't say I don't permit it. He says you can't. You can't. They are mutually exclusive. You can't do both. You have to make a choice. Right? And he's not putting that choice upon you. I mean, not saying you have to do this or I won't love you. You won't be able to serve me if you're serving this. You just won't be able to. Okay? Now, the Pharisees, who were lovers of money, were listening to all these things and were scoffing at him. How did I translate that? Sniffing in oh,
Hopefully.
yeah, but a sniffing discontent, and so scoffing at him. And just imagine, they're having their bubble burst, and they're not liking it. So they're scoffing it. It doesn't say what they said. Maybe you just look at them rolling their eyes. You ever had anybody roll their eyes at you? All the time, even over the phone. I don't know how women do it, but they know when you've rolled your eyes at them, even when it's a phone call. Okay,
They
and
have
so
radar.
yeah, but that scoffing, that oh yeah, right. And so something was going on that Jesus saw and that multitudes were witnessing. Verbal and nonverbal communication is going on here. They're just their body language, their attitude, the smirk. And so Jesus said to them, he didn't say about them. He didn't, as he sometimes does, talks to the multitude about the attitude. This time he just talked straight to them. He said, you are those who justify yourselves in the sight of men. What does he mean by that? You just, now, kid, stay it in context. We're talking about those who are lovers of money. Okay? What's he talking about?
I think it's like the guys that were giving money, and then the little lady gets the two pennies.
Okay.
It's kind of like that. Oh, look at how holy he is. He's got given so much.
What I thought of was Matthew 15, where you hypocrites, you will say to your parents, whom you're supposed to honor, that which you would have benefited from me has been given to God. Oh, okay, that was a holy thing to do. Maybe he made a contribution to the temple on their behalf. He looked good doing it. And you justify it. You say, well, that's perfect. So you see, they're lovers of money, but they find ways to make it look like they're being religious about it.
Mm-hmm.
You justify yourselves in the sight of men. So men think, that's a pretty cool thing. That's an illustration. It may not be that alone, but that would typify holding on to your money while it still looks like you're giving it to God because you gave it on behalf of your parents, and now you don't have to take care of your parents. You double down, you do two things, and it only costs you one thing. And everybody approves of it. He says, God knows your hearts. And if there is a statement in here that really sums up what we're trying to get at, is that one. God knows your hearts. So he knows whether you are focused on making a living just so you can get by, or if having money is your goal. He knows your hearts. And so you approve of each other doing this. You got mutual pat on the back. Club. I'll pat you on the back. You pat me on the back. We'll both feel good about ourselves because we patted each other on the back because this is what we want to do. But God knows the hearts. For that which is highly esteemed among men is detestable in the sight of God. Why would I do something that my God detests? Well, you can't serve two masters. You can't serve riches and God. And they were finding ways to keep riches as their goal. Acquire riches, become rich. Seven easy steps to make $1 million in your lifetime, or get rich. And I don't know what I want to say here. There are programs both on the radio and promoted an advertisement on the internet of how to increase your wealth.
Well, we know a lot of the ways they were getting rich.
Yeah.
By doing at the temple with the animals.
Yeah.
I mean, they're running a shell game.
Yeah.
Robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Robbing Peter to put it in their pocket.
In their pocket.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then they justify it.
Mm-hmm.
I am the priest who has the right to say whether an animal is fit to be sacrificed. The one you brought in isn't, but I've got one for sale here.
On second thought, that one is.
So,
he didn't hear.
So he buys the animal for a pittance and sells the other animal for three or four pittances, and then turns around and blesses this animal and sells it to the next guy. And he's just patting his pocket and making it look good because he has the right to do that. And after all, we're serving God here, aren't we? But God knows the heart. Verse 16. The law and the prophets until John. Now, some versions insert the word proclaimed and don't put it in italics. But I tell you, it's not in the Greek text. It's just the law and the prophets until John. That's what it says. But now the gospel is being preached. The gospel, since then, see, up until John, what are the law and the prophets? What are they all about? There's one word that I'm looking for. This promise. Mm-hmm. Promise of a kingdom ruled by Messiah. And what does gospel mean?
Good news.
Good news. Well, once John got here, what was the good news?
That king is here.
The law and what the law and the prophets promised us is available now. That's the good news. Okay, so since John, the good news has been preached. And everyone is forcing his way into it. What does that mean? I think some in other places, not in Luke, but maybe in Matthew, violent men are forcing their way into it. Violent men are taking it by force. What's the picture you have?
Like somebody starving, trying to get to the food. They're forcing their way in because they know that's the truth.
Okay. I have a bit different picture than that. I have the picture of trying to wrest control of the kingdom and access to the kingdom from God, from Jesus. They're trying to take over. Yeah, Michael.
I was just going to say that they had a high expectation knowing of the kingdom was going to be there, and here John as the prophet proclaiming that the kingdom was at hand, and knowing that within the fourth kingdom of Daniel too, they knew what was coming.
Well, I think the idea of forcing their way into it is more than just they know it's coming. I think it's they're trying to take over. Who gets to be part of it?
Is it like, oh, okay. I was thinking maybe by forcing their way in, they're trying to make it in on their own merit instead of by faith.
I think that too. I think both.
Okay.
That they're where is that? I forget where it says, but they denied the council of God against themselves by not being baptized.
Mm-hmm.
They rejected God's will for them.
Mm-hmm.
I want to do it my way. I want to get into the kingdom. And why did once Lazarus was raised from the dead, John 11, remember what they said? If we let this go on, then we're going to lose the kingdom. We're going to lose the king. They wanted to maintain control.
So people are invited into the kingdom, but only a certain type of person is invited into the kingdom, right?
Many are called, few are chosen.
Yeah. So only a person, only the faithful are actually invited in. Anybody that's not faithful to try to get in would be forcing their way in.
Yeah. And here is... I see your hand, Michael. Let me make this point first. Here is what Jesus is saying. These guys, I think, here's what these guys are scoffing at him.
Mm-hmm.
They're scoffing at him. Okay? And so I see him saying, there are a lot of guys like you who are trying to wrest control over kingdom access. They want to be the ones that the people have to follow.
Mm-hmm.
The king, the law and the prophets up until John, but now that John is here, the gospel, the good news of the kingdom is being proclaimed, and you guys are trying to co-opt it.
Yeah, because of the even their concept of what Messiah was.
Yeah.
Now he's gonna come in, he's gonna, sure, beat up the Romans, and then we're gonna be in power.
Yeah, no, that's exactly, and I think that's what Jesus is addressing. They're scoffing at him teaching about money.
Mm-hmm.
They're not willing to acknowledge that he was the voice of God among them. Okay, Devin, go ahead.
It's Not exactly what you were saying, but it makes me think of like when the Titanic was going down and they called women and children into the lifeboats, and you maybe had some men who muscled their way onto the lifeboats, forcing their way
Now
in.
that is not identical, but it's illustrating of me first, my way first. Okay. Jesus said to that, it is easier for heaven and earth to pass away than for one stroke of a letter of the law to fail. What's he getting at? And you have to go back to where he says, the law and the prophets until John. Now, that's where the letter of the law was. What God said is going to happen, and it's easier for heaven and earth to pass away than for God's promise to fail. And I think he's pointing his finger right into their chest and saying, you who are trying to force your way in, and God's word is not going to fail. It's going to be done God's way. Now, what is the failure or the heaven and earth passing away? Any thoughts on that? And this is where the book of Isaiah opened up to me. Isaiah constantly talking about heaven and earth, heaven and earth, heaven and earth, and then connecting that to the idea of the New Jerusalem. And so heaven and earth, conceptually, where is that? That's where we live. That's the dwelling place of God, our man with God. And the promise of a new heavens and a new earth would take place when? Any thoughts? When did God in Isaiah say that the new heavens and the new earth, the new Jerusalem, would take place?
Space.
When the old things passed away,
Yeah.
the old things of Moses, when those were gone, the new heavens, the new earth would come. Does it surprise you that Josephus, in his writings, said that the Jews referred to the temple as heaven and earth? And the function of a temple was a portal in which God and man met, heaven and earth. And so the Jews, at least twice in the writings of Josephus, he referred to the temple as heaven, that the Jews called it heaven and earth. And that either Isaiah's concept of the old earth and the old heaven would pass away for the new heaven and new earth to continue, that his word is not going to be violated just because you're trying to take over. It's going to be done his way. I think that's generalizing it, that would be the best way to say it. It doesn't matter how I perceive that God would accomplish his eschatology. I mean, it just doesn't. Jim and I disagree, not Jim Ulrich, but Jim Brass and I have glaringly different concepts of end times. Okay? Doesn't matter. What God says is going to happen is what's going to happen, my understanding notwithstanding. And so he says, put my hand in God's hand and say, I think this is what he said, but I'm not going to whittle on his end of the stick. It'll be what he wants it to be. Okay? And I'm not going to fall out with anybody who disagrees with me. This just not worth it. And then we have, oh, look, our time is gone. And then we have verse 18. It's kind of like, where did that come from?
Yeah, that's the weird,
Where did that come from?
parts of this.
Everyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery, and he who marries the one who is divorced from a husband commits adultery. And I have to admit to you that there's no, it's just like this is a verse that if it's talking about adultery, is totally out of context. But if it's talking about
Right.
the bride, and the changing of covenants for God to marry somebody else after he married Israel and Judah, He had to divorce her. Okay. We cannot continue to have the Judaistic approach to relationship with God when the new covenant comes in. And to me, that makes a lot of sense. And Paul in Romans 7 says the same thing. You cannot be married to Christ if you're still married to the law. And then he used the same idea of divorce. So that's the way it makes sense to me. Some people like to just isolate that and talk about the relationship of marriage, divorce, and remarriage. And I don't think that's what was on Jesus' mind at all here. He was upbraiding the Pharisees who scoffed at Jesus' teaching on focus, whether wealth or God, because they were lovers of money, and how that they were trying to take over the ruling and guiding the kingdom when it was God's word that was being fulfilled. And so it makes sense to me to see it that way. And that's probably all I'm going to say about that.
Did you answer Michael's question?
Did I answer? Oh, Michael, you have a question.
No, what I would just say thank you for that, because I think you have to look at it contextually all the way up to back into 16, the law and the prophets, and what his whole understanding, and we're looking at from thousands of years later, but to the context of the people he was talking to. And like you say, that the marriage motif is very prominent throughout the Old Testament and God's divorce. Anyway, he changes it also in 19. It says, now there was a rich man. He changes his context and his subject the next verse, but we can go on that next week.
I don't think he changes. I think he embellishes the idea of a man who didn't use his money properly and just the unjust. And he's still talking about the unjust steward and his focus on taking care of himself rather than taking care of God's business. So I think, and that's another reason I think this verse 18 is not a toss it in there, because it doesn't make sense to be tossed in anywhere else. Rather, it is an illustration of these guys who are trying to take over the kingdom have to be disconnected from that first covenant in order to be part of the second. All right, we got to stop there. Our time is a little past our time, and we'll pick up with the verse 19 then next week.